Don't be shy. Step right up and see what the junkman's brought you. Got handy appliances, tools, and gadgets from all across the country. Got toys for the kiddies, antiques from a vanished age. And my own inventions, specially designed to aid and delight in this modern age. And God knows we all need a little aid and delight, don't we? So step right up. Come one, come all. People began to crowd around the tables, gawking at what the junk man had brought. Gaudy women's clothing, including spangled party dresses and color-splashed bathing suits, high-heeled shoes, penny loafers, saddle oxfords, and jogging sneakers. Men's short-sleeved summer shirts by the box full, most of them still with their department store tags. Can openers, frying pans, toasters, blenders, clocks, transistor radios and television sets, lamps, garden hoses, lawn chairs, umbrellas and bird feeders, yo-yos, hula hoops, boxed games like Monopoly and Risk, stuffed teddy bears, little toy cars and trucks, dolls and model airplane kits. Volsevik's own inventions included a shaving razor that ran on the power of wound-up rubber bands, eyeglasses with little rubber band-powered windshield wipers on the lenses, and a small vacuum cleaner run by a rubber band-operated motor. "What do you take for this?" a woman asked, holding up a glitter-covered scarf. "Got any rubber bands?" he inquired. But when she shook her head, he told her to go home and bring back what she had to trade, and maybe they could do business. "I'll trade for whatever you've got," he told the crowd. "Chickens, canned food, combs, boots, wristwatches, you bring 'em and let's deal." He caught a fragrant aroma in the air and turned to his wife. "Am I going crazy?" he asked her. "Or do I smell apples?" A woman's hand took an object off the table in front of Volsevik. "That's a one-of-a-kind item right there, lady," Volsevik said. "Yes, ma'am. You don't see craftsmanship like that anymore. Go ahead. Shake it." She did. Tiny snowflakes flew over the roofs of a town within the glass ball she held. "Pretty, huh?" Volsevik asked. "Yes," the woman answered. Her pale blue eyes watched the glittery flakes fall. "How much is it?" "Oh, I'd say 2 cans of food at least, but since you like it so much..." He paused, examining his potential customer. She was square-shouldered and sturdy, and she looked like she could spot a lie a mile off. She had thick gray hair trimmed just above her shoulders and brushed back from a widow's peak at her forehead. Her skin was smooth and unlined like a newborn baby's, and it was hard to judge how old she was. Maybe her hair was prematurely gray, Volsevik thought. But then again, something about her eyes was old, as if they'd seen and remembered a lifetime of struggle. She was a handsome woman, with even, lovely features, a regal look, Volsevik decided, and he imagined that before the 17th of July, she might have worn furs and diamonds and had a mansion full of servants. But there was kindness in her face, too, and he thought, in the next second, that maybe she'd been a teacher or a social worker or maybe a missionary. She held a leather satchel securely under her other arm. A businesswoman, Volsevik thought. Yeah, that's what she used to be. Probably owned her own business. "Well," he said, "what have you got to trade, lady?" He nodded toward the satchel. She smiled slightly, her eyes meeting his. "You can call me sister," she said. "And I'm sorry, but I can't give up what I've got in here."
"Can't hold on to things forever," Volsevik said with a shrug. "Got to pass them along. That's the American way."
"I guess so," Sister agreed, but she didn't loosen her grip on the satchel.
She shook the glass ball again and watched the snowflakes whirl. Then she returned it to the table.
"Thank you," she said. "I'm just looking."
"Well, now," someone beside her reached into a box and lifted out a tarnished stethoscope. "Talk about relics." Hugh Ryan hooked it around his neck. "How do I look?"
"Very professional,"
I thought so. Hugh couldn't help but stare at her new face, though he'd seen it often enough in the last 2 days. Robin had taken a few men back to the cave after Hugh and the rest of the boys, and had brought all of them to live in Mary's Rest. "What do you take for this?" Hugh asked Bolshevik. "A valuable thing like that? It depends. You know, I might run into a doctor someday who really would need it. I can't be selling that to just anybody. What do you trade for it?" "I think I can get you a few rubber bands."
"Sold."
A giant figure stepped beside Sister, and Bolshevik looked up at a gnarled, growth-covered face as Hugh moved away. He flinched only a little bit because he was used to such sights. The giant's arm was in a sling, and his broken fingers were bandaged and splinted with popsicle sticks, courtesy of the town's new physician.
"How about this?"
Josh asked Sister, holding up a long black dress covered with shining spangles.
"Do you think she'd like it?"
"Oh, yes. She'd look great at the next opera opening."
"I think Gloria would like it," he decided. "I mean, even if she didn't, she could use the material, couldn't she?" "I'll take this," he told Bolshevik, laying the dress across the table.
"And this, too." He picked up a green plastic toy tractor.
"Good choice. What have you got to trade?"
Josh hesitated, and he said,
"Wait a minute. I'll be right back."
And he walked toward Glory's shack, limping on his left leg. Sister watched him go. He was as strong as a bull, but the man with the scarlet eye had almost killed him. He had a badly sprained shoulder, a bruised left kneecap, 3 broken fingers, and a fractured rib, and he was covered with abrasions and cuts that were still healing. Josh was very lucky to be alive. But the man with the scarlet eye had vacated his lair under the burned-out church. By the time Sister had gotten there, along with Paul, Anna, and a half-dozen men with rifles and shotguns, the man had gone. And though the hole had been watched around the clock for 4 days, he hadn't returned. The hole had been filled up, and work was proceeding on rebuilding the church. But whether he'd left Mary's Rest or not, Sister didn't know. She remembered the message Josh had brought back. "I'll make a human hand do the work." People pushed in around her, examining the items as if they were fragments of an alien culture. Sister browsed through the stuff, junk now, but years ago things no household would have been without. She picked up an egg timer and let it fall back into the box, along with rolling pins, cookie molds, and kitchen tools. A multicolored cube lay on the table, and she recalled that such things had been known as Rubik's Cubes. She picked up an old calendar illustrated with a pipe-smoking fisherman fly-casting into a blue stream.
"That's only 8 years old," Bolshevik told her. "You can figure out the dates from it if you count backwards. I like to keep up with the days myself, like today. It's the 11th of June, or the 12th. Anyway, one or the other."
"Where'd you get all this?"
"Here, there. We've been traveling for a long time. Too long, I guess."
"Hey, interested in a nice silver locket? See?"
He flipped it open, but Sister glanced quickly away from the small yellowed photo of a smiling little girl inside it.
"Oh,"
Bolshevik said, and he knew his salesmanship had gotten away from him.
"Sorry."
He closed the locket. "Maybe I shouldn't sell this, huh?"
"No, you should bury it."
"Yeah." He put it away and regarded the low, dark snow clouds.
"Some morning in June, huh?"
He gazed around at the shacks while his 2 sons dealt with the customers.
"How many people live here?"
"I'm not sure. Maybe 500 or 600. New people are coming in all the time."
"Yeah, I guess so. Looks like you've got a good water supply here. The houses aren't so bad."
"We've seen plenty worse.
Know what we heard on the road coming here?" He grinned. "You've got a big cornfield, and apples fall out of the sky. Isn't that the funniest thing you've ever heard?"
Sister smiled.
"And
There's supposed to be a girl here named Swan or something like that who can make crops grow. Just touch the dirt and they spring up. How about that? I tell you, the whole country would be dead if it wasn't for imagination.
Are you planning on staying here?
Yeah, for a few days at least. It looks okay. I'll tell you, we wouldn't go north again, no ma'am.
Why? What's north?
Death, Volsovic said. He scowled, shook his head. Some people have gone off their rockers. We heard that there's fighting going on up north. There's some kind of damned army up there. Just this side of the Iowa line, or what used to be Iowa. Anyway, it's damned dangerous to go north, so we're heading south.
An army?
Sister remembered Hugh Ryan telling her and Paul about the Battlelands.
What kind of army?
The kind that kills you, lady. You know, men and guns. Supposed to be 2,000 or 3,000 soldiers on the march up there, looking for people to kill. I don't know what the hell they're doing. Little tin bastards. Crap like that got us in the mess we're in.
Have you seen them?
Volsovic's wife had been listening, and now she stepped to her husband's side.
No, she told Sister, but we saw the lights of their fires one night. They were in the distance like a burning city. Right after that, we found a man on the road, all cut up and half dead. He called himself Brother David, and he told us about the fighting. He said the worst of it was near Lincoln, Nebraska, but that they were still hunting down the Savior's people. That's what he said, and he died before we could make sense of it. But we turned south and got out of there.
You'd better pray they don't come through here, Volsovic said to Sister. Little tin bastards. Sister nodded, and Volsovic went over to dicker with somebody about a wristwatch. If an army was indeed on the march this side of the Iowa line, it meant they might be within 100 miles of Mary's Rest. Oh, God, she thought. If 2,000 or 3,000 soldiers swept into Mary's Rest, they'd smash it to the ground. And she thought also of what she'd been seeing lately in the glass ring, and she went cold inside. Almost at the same instant, she felt a frigid wave of, yes, she thought, of hatred wash over her, and she knew he was behind her, or beside her, or somewhere very near. She felt his stare on her, like a claw poised at the back of her neck. She whirled quickly around, her nerves screaming in alarm. But all the people around her seemed interested only in what lay on the tables or in the boxes. There was no one staring at her, and now the frigid wave seemed to be ebbing, as if the man with the scarlet eye, wherever and whoever he was, had begun to move away. Still, his cold presence lingered in the air. He was close, somewhere very close, hidden in the crowd. She caught a sudden movement to her right, sensed a figure reaching for her. A hand was outstretched, about to touch her face. She turned and saw a man in a dark coat standing too close for her to escape. She cringed backward, and then the man's slender arm glided past her face like a snake. "How much for this?" he asked Volsovic. In his hand was a little wind-up toy monkey, chattering and banging two small cymbals together. "What do you have?" The man dug out a pocket knife and handed it over. Volsovic examined it closely, then nodded. "It's yours, friend." The other man smiled and gave the toy to a child who stood beside him, waiting patiently.
"Here,"
Josh Hutchins said as he came through the crowd back to the table. In his good hand, he was carrying something wrapped up in brown cloth.
"How about this?"
He put the cloth down on the table next to the spangled black dress. Volsovic opened the cloth and stared numbly at what was inside.
"Oh, my God," he whispered.
Lying in front of him were 5 ears of golden corn.
"I figured you might want one for each of you," Josh said. "Is that all right?"
Volsovic picked one of them up as his wife stared spellbound over his shoulder. He smelled it and said,
"It's real. My God! This is real. It's so fresh I can still smell the earth on it."
"Sure,"
We've got a whole field of corn growing not too far from here.
Bolshevik looked as if he might keel over.
Well, Josh asked, do we have a deal or not?
Yes! Yes! Sure! Take the dress. Take whatever you want. My God, this is fresh corn!
He looked over at the man who wanted the wristwatch.
Take it, he said. Hell, take a handful. Hey, lady, you want that scarf? It's yours. I can't believe this.
He touched Josh's good arm as Josh carefully picked up Glory's new dress.
Show me, he begged. Please, show me. It's been so long since I've seen anything growing. Please.
All right, I'll take you out to the field.
Josh motioned for him to follow.
Boys, watch the merchandise,
Bolshevik told his sons, and then he looked around at the faces of the crowd and he said,
hell, give them whatever they want. They can have any of it.
He and his wife and daughter started following Josh out to the field where the golden corn was ripening by the basketful. Shaken and nervous, Sister was still aware of the cold presence. She began walking back to Glory's house, holding the satchel tightly under her arm. She still felt as if she were being watched, and if he was indeed out there somewhere, she wanted to get into the house and away from him. She was almost at the porch when she heard a shouted,
"No!"
And an instant later, the noise of the truck's engine roaring to life. She whirled around. The junk man's truck was backing up, running over the tables and smashing the boxes of merchandise. People screamed and fled out of its path. Volsovic's two sons were trying to climb up to get at the driver, but one of them stumbled and fell, and the other wasn't quick enough. The truck's tires ran over a woman who had fallen to the ground, and Sister heard her back break. A child was in the way, but was pulled to safety as the truck roared backward along the road. Then the truck swerved and veered, crashing into the front of another shack, and it started to turn around. The tires threw snow and dirt as the vehicle lurched forward, backfired, and sped along the road out of Mary's Rest, heading north. Sister got her feet moving, running to help some of the people who had fallen and narrowly missed being crushed. The junkman's delights, antiques, and inventions lay all over the street, and Sister saw things flying out of the rear of the truck as it rocketed away, skidded around a curve, and went out of sight.
"He stole my dad's truck!"
one of Volsovic's sons was shouting, almost hysterical.
"He stole my dad's truck!"
The other boy ran off to get his father. Sister had a feeling of dread that hit her in the stomach like a punch. She ran to the boy's side and grabbed his arm. He was still stunned, tears of anger streaming from his dark eyes.
"Who was it?" she asked him. "What did he look like?" I don't know. His face... I don't know. "Did he say anything to you? Think."
"No," the boy shook his head. "No, he just was there, right in front of me, and I saw him smile. Then he picked them up and ran to the truck."
"Picked them up? Picked what up?"
"The corn," the boy said. "He stole the corn, too."
Sister released his arm and stood staring along the road, staring toward the north, where the army was.
"Oh, my God,"
Sister said hoarsely. She held the leather satchel in both hands and felt the circle of glass within it. For the last 2 weeks, she'd gone dreamwalking in a nightmare land, where the rivers ran with blood and the sky was the color of open wounds, and a skeleton on a skeletal horse reaped a field of humanity. "I'll make a human hand do the work," he'd promised. A human hand. Sister looked back at Glory's house. Swan was standing on the porch, wearing her patchwork coat of many colors, her gaze also directed to the north. Then Sister started walking toward her to tell her what had happened and what she feared was about to happen when the man with the scarlet eye reached that army and showed them the fresh corn. When he told them about Swan and made them understand that a march of 100 miles was nothing to find a girl who could grow crops out of dead earth. Enough crops to feed an army. Chapter 78.
"Bring him in," Roland Croninger ordered. The two sentries escorted the stranger up the steps to Colonel Macklin's trailer. Roland saw the stranger's left hand caress one of the demonic faces carved into the wood. In his right hand, the stranger carried something wrapped in a brown cloth. Both sentries had their pistols pointed at the stranger's head because he refused to give up the package, and he'd already snapped the arm of one soldier who tried to take it from him. He'd been stopped 2 hours before by a sentry on the southern edge of the AOE's camp and immediately taken to Roland Croninger for questioning. Roland had taken one look at the stranger and realized that he was an extraordinary man. But the stranger had refused to answer any questions, saying that he'd speak only to the army's leader. Roland couldn't get the package away from him, and no badgering or threats of torture made any impression on the stranger. Roland doubted that any man who wore nothing but faded jeans, sneakers, and a brightly colored, summery, short-sleeved shirt in freezing weather would be bothered very much by torture. Roland stepped aside as they brought the man in. Other armed guards stood around the room, and Macklin had summoned Captain Carr and Wilson, Lieutenant Thatcher, Sergeant Benning, and Corporal Mangrum. The colonel sat behind his desk, and there was a chair at the center of the room reserved for the stranger. Next to it was a small table on which rested a burning oil lamp.
"Sit down," Roland said, and the man obeyed. "I think all of you can see for yourselves why I wanted you to meet this man," Roland said quietly, the lamplight sparking red in his goggles. "This is exactly what he was wearing when he was found. He says he won't talk to anybody but Colonel Macklin." "Okay, mister," he told the stranger. "Here's your chance."
The stranger glanced around the room, examining each man in turn. His gaze lingered a bit longer on Alvin Mangrum.
"Hey," Mangrum said. "I know you from somewhere, don't I?"
"It's possible."
The stranger had a hoarse, raspy voice. It was the voice of someone just overcoming an illness. Macklin studied him. The stranger looked to be a young man, maybe 25 or 30. He had curly brown hair and a pleasant blue-eyed face, and he was beardless. On his shirt were green parrots and red palm trees. Macklin hadn't seen a shirt like that since the day the bombs fell. It was a shirt made for a tropical beach, not for a 30-degree afternoon.
"Where the hell did you come from?"
Macklin asked him. The young man's eyes found his.
"Oh, yes," he said. "You'd be in charge, wouldn't you? I ask you a question. I've brought you something."
The young man suddenly tossed his present toward Macklin's desk, and at once two guards were sticking rifle barrels in his face. Macklin cringed, had a mental image of a bomb ripping him apart, and started to dive to the floor. But the package hit the desk top and came open. What was inside rolled over his maps of Missouri. Macklin was silent, staring at the 5 ears of corn. Roland crossed the room and picked one of them up, and a couple of the other officers crowded around as well.
"Get those out of my face,"
the young man told the guards, but they hesitated until Roland ordered them to lower their rifles.
"Where'd you get these?"
Roland demanded. He could still smell the dirt on the ear of corn in his hand.
"You've asked me enough questions. Now it's my turn. How many men are out there?"
He nodded toward the trailer's wall, beyond which sprawled the camp and its dozens of bonfires. Neither Roland nor the colonel answered him.
"If you're going to play games with me," the stranger said, smiling thinly, "I'll take my toys and go home. You don't really want me to do that, do you?"
It was Colonel Macklin who finally broke the silence.
"We've got about 3,000. We lost a lot of soldiers back in Nebraska."
"All those 3,000 are able-bodied men?"
"Who are you?"
Macklin asked. He was very cold, and he noted Captain Carr blowing into his hands to warm them.
"Are those 3,000 able to fight?"
"No. We've got about 400 sick or wounded, and we're carrying maybe 1,000 women and children. So you've only got 1,600 soldiers?"
The young man clenched the chair's armrests. Macklin saw something change about him, something almost imperceptible. And then he realized the young man's left eye was turning brown.
I thought this was an army, not a Boy Scout troop.
You're talking to officers of the Army of Excellence, Roland said, quietly but menacingly. I don't give a shit who you...
And then he saw the brown eye, too, and his throat seized up.
Some great army, the other man sneered. Fucking great.
His complexion was reddening, and his jowls seemed to be swelling up.
You've got a few guns and trucks, and you think you're soldiers? You're shit.
He almost screamed it, and then the single blue eye bled pallid gray.
What's your rank?
He asked Macklin. Everyone was silent, because they'd seen too. And then Alvin Mangrum, smiling and cheerful and already in love with the stranger, said,
He's a colonel.
A colonel, the stranger echoed.
Well, colonel, I think the time has come for the Army of Excellence to be led by a five-star general.
A streak of black rippled through his hair. Alvin Mangrum laughed and clapped his hands.
What are you feeding your 1,600 soldiers?
The stranger stood up, and the men around Macklin's desk retreated, bumping into one another. He snapped his fingers when Macklin didn't reply fast enough.
Speak!
Macklin was dumbfounded. No one but the Kong guards at the prison camp a lifetime ago had ever dared to speak to him like this. Ordinarily, he would have slashed the offender to shreds for this kind of disrespect. But he couldn't argue with a man who had a face like a molting chameleon and wore a short-sleeved shirt when others were shivering in fleece-lined overcoats. He felt suddenly weakened, as if this young stranger was sucking the energy and willpower right out of him. The stranger commanded his attention like a magnet, and his presence filled the room with waves of cold that had begun to crisscross like frigid tides. He looked around for some kind of help from the others, but saw that they were mesmerized and impotent too, and even Roland had backed away. His fist clenched at his sides. The young stranger lowered his head. He remained that way for about 30 seconds. When he lifted his face again, it was pleasant, and both eyes were blue once more, but the black streak remained in his curly brown hair.
I'm sorry, he said with a disarming smile. I'm not myself today. Really, though, I'd like to know, what are you feeding your troops?
We captured some canned food from the American Allegiance,
Macklin said at last.
Some cases of canned soup and stew, some canned vegetables and fruit. How long will that supply last? A week? 2 weeks?
We're marching east, Roland told him, getting himself under control, to West Virginia. We'll raid other settlements on the way.
To West Virginia. What's in West Virginia?
A mountain where God lives, Roland said. The black box and the silver key. Brother Timothy's going to lead us. Brother Timothy had been tough, but he'd cracked under Roland's attentions in the black trailer. According to Brother Timothy, God had a silver key that he had inserted into a black box, and a doorway had opened in solid stone. Within Warwick Mountain, so Brother Timothy had said, were corridors and electric lights and humming machines that made spools of tape spin around, and the machines had spoken to God, reading off numbers and facts that had been way over Brother Timothy's head. And the more Roland had thought about that story, the more he'd come to believe a very interesting thing. That the man who called himself God had shown Brother Timothy a room full of mainframe computers still hooked up to a power source. And if there were mainframe computers still in operation under Warwick Mountain, West Virginia, Roland wanted to find out why they were there, what information they held, and why somebody had made sure they'd keep functioning even after a total nuclear holocaust.
A mountain where God lives, the stranger repeated. Well, I'd like to see that mountain myself.
He blinked, and his right eye was green. No one moved, not even the guards with the rifles.
Look at the corn,
the stranger urged.
Smell it. It's fresh, picked, right off the stalk a couple of days ago.
I know where there's a whole field of corn growing, and pretty soon there'll be apple trees growing there too, hundreds of them. How long has it been since any of you tasted an apple, or cornbread, or smelled corn frying in a pan?
His gaze crept around the circle of men.
I'll bet way too long.
Where?
Macklin's mouth was watering.
Where's the field?
Oh, about 120 miles south of here, in a little town called Mary's Rest. They've got a spring there, too. You can fill up your bottles and kegs with water that tastes like sunshine.
His eyes of different colors glinted, and he walked to the edge of Macklin's desk.
There's a girl who lives in that town,
the young man said. He planted his palms on the desk and leaned forward.
Her name is Swan. I'd like you to meet her, because she's the one who made that corn grow out of dead earth, and she planted apple seeds, and they're going to grow too.
He grinned, but there was rage in it, and dark pigment rose like a birthmark across his cheek.
She can make crops grow. I've seen what she can do, and if you had her, then you could feed your army while everybody else starved. Do you see what I mean?
Macklin shivered from the cold that came off the man's body, but he couldn't look away from those gleaming eyes.
Why are you telling me this? What's in it for you?
Oh, let's just say I want to be on the winning team.
The dark pigment disappeared.
We're marching to Warwick Mountain, Roland contended. We can't go 120 miles out of our way.
The mountain will wait,
the stranger said softly, still staring at Macklin.
First, I'll take you to get the girl. Then you can go find God or Samson and Delilah if you want to. But first, the girl and the food.
Yes,
Macklin nodded, his eyes glazed and his jaw sagging.
Yes. First the girl, and the food.
The young man smiled, and slowly his eyes became the same shade of blue. He was feeling so much better now, so much stronger. Fit as a fiddle, he thought. Maybe it was being here among people he sensed had the right ideas. Yes, war was a good thing. It trimmed the population and made sure only the strong survived, so the next generation would be better. He'd always been an advocate of the humane nature of war. Maybe he was also feeling stronger because he was away from that girl. That damned little bitch was tormenting those poor souls in Mary's Rest, making them believe their lives were worth living again. And that sort of deception would not be tolerated. He picked up the map of Missouri with his left hand and held it up before him while his right hand snaked down behind it. Roland saw a blue wisp of smoke rise and smelled a burning candle, and then a scorched circle began to appear on the map, about 120 miles south of their present position. When the circle was complete, the stranger let the map slide back onto the desk in front of Macklin. His right hand was clenched into a fist, and a haze of smoke hung around it.
"That's where we're going," he said.
Alvin Mangrum beamed like a happy child.
Right on, bro.
For the first time in his life, Macklin felt faint. Something had spun out of control. The gears of the great war machine that was the Army of Excellence had begun to turn of their own accord. He realized in that moment that he didn't really care about the Mark of Cain, or about purifying the human race, or about rebuilding to fight the Russians. All that had been what he'd told the others, to make them believe the AOE had a higher cause, and make himself believe it too. Now, he knew all he'd ever wanted was to be feared and respected again, like he'd been when he was a younger man fighting in foreign fields before his reflexes had slowed down. He'd wanted people to call him Sir, and not have a smirk in their eyes when they did it. He wanted to be somebody again, instead of a drone locked in a flabby bag of bones and dreaming of the past.
He realized he'd crossed a point of no return somewhere along the current of time that had swept him and Roland Croninger out of Earth House. There was no going back now, no going back ever. But part of him, deep inside, suddenly screamed and cowered in a dark hole, waiting for something fearsome to come lift the lid and offer him food.
"Who are you?"
he whispered. The stranger leaned forward until his face was only inches from Macklin's. Deep in the man's eyes, Macklin thought he saw slits of scarlet. The stranger said,
"You can call me friend."
Chapter 79.
"They're going to come," Sister said. "I know they are. My question is, what are we going to do when they get here?"
"We shoot their damn heads off," a skinny black man said, standing up from the rough-hewn bench.
"Yes, sir. We got us enough guns to make 'em turn tail."
"Right," another man agreed on the other side of the church. "We're not going to let the bastards come in here and take whatever they want."
There was a murmur of angry agreement in the crowd of more than 100 people who jammed into the half-built church, but many others shouted a dissent.
"Listen," a woman said, rising from her seat. "If what she says is true, and there are a couple of thousand soldiers on the way here, we're crazy to think we can stand up to them. We've got to pack up whatever we can carry and get..."
"No!"
a gray-bearded man thundered from the next row. He stood up, his face streaked with burn scars and livid with rage.
"No, by God! We stay here, where our homes are. Mary's Rest didn't used to be worth spit on a griddle, but look at it now. Hell, we've got a town here. We're building things back."
He looked around at the crowd, his eyes dark and furious. About 8 feet over his head, oil lamps hung from the exposed rafters and cast a muted golden light over the assembly. Smoke from the lanterns rose up into the night because there was no roof yet.
"I got a shotgun that says me and my wife are going to stay right here," he continued, "and we're going to die here if we have to. We ain't running from nobody no more."
"Wait a minute. Just everybody hold on now."
A big-boned man in a denim jacket and khaki trousers stood up.
"What's everybody going crazy for? This woman tacks up these things."
He held up one of the crudely printed bulletin sheets that said, "Emergency meeting tonight, everybody come."
"And we all start jabbering like a bunch of idiots. So she stands up there at the front and says some kind of damned army is going to be marching through here in..."
He glanced at Sister. "How long did you say it'd be?"
"I don't know, 3 or 4 days, maybe. They've got trucks and cars, and they're going to be moving fast once they get started."
"Uh-huh. Well, you get up there and start on about an army coming this way, and we all shit our britches."
"How do you know that? And what are they after? I mean, if they want to fight a war, they sure could find a better place. I mean, we're all Americans here, not Ruskies."
"What's your name?" Sister asked him.
"Bud Royce. That is, Captain Bud Royce, ex-Arkansas National Guard. See, I know a little about armies myself."
"Good, Captain Royce. I'll tell you exactly what they're after. Our crops, and our water, too, most likely. I can't tell you how I know so you'd understand it, but I do know they're coming, and they're going to tear Mary's Rest to the ground."
She held the leather satchel, and within it was the glass circle that had taken her dream walking on a savage landscape where the skeleton on his mound of bones held sway. She looked at Swan, who sat beside Josh in the front row and was listening carefully, and then back at Bud Royce.
"Just believe it. They're going to be here soon, and we'd better decide right now what to do."
"We fight!"
a man at the back shouted.
"How can we fight?"
an old man who supported himself on a cane asked in a quavering voice.
"We can't stand up against an army. We'd be fools to even try such a thing."
"We'd be damned cowards if we didn't," a woman said over on the left.
"Yeah, but better live cowards than dead heroes,"
a young bearded man sitting behind Josh contended.
I'm getting out. That's a crock of buttered bullshit, Anna McClay roared, standing up from her bench. She put her hands on her wide hips and regarded the crowd, her upper lip curled in a sneer. God almighty! What's the point of living if you don't fight for what you hold dear? We work our butts to the bone cleaning this town up and building this church back, and we're gonna run at the first sniff of real trouble? She grunted and shook her finger in disgust. I remember what Mary's Rest used to be, and most of you folks do too. But I see what it is now and what it can be. If we were to run, where would we go? Some other hole in the ground? And what happens when that damned army decides to come marching in our direction again? I say if we run once, we're as good as dead anyway, so we might as well go down fighting.
Yeah, that's what I say too, Mr. Pulowski added. I've got a wife and kids, Volsovic said, his face stricken with fear. I don't want to die, and I don't want them to die either. I don't know anything about fighting.
It's time you learned, then. Paul Thorson stood up and walked along the aisle in the front. Listen, he said, standing beside Sister. We all know the score, don't we? We know where we used to be, and we know where we are now. If we give up Mary's Rest without a fight, we'll all be wanderers again, and we'll know we didn't have the guts to even try to keep it. I, for one, am pretty damn lazy. I don't want to go on the road again, and so I'm sticking right here.
As the people shouted out their opinions, Sister looked at Paul and smiled faintly.
What's this? Another layer on the shit cake?
No, he said, his eyes electric blue and steely. I believe my cake's about baked, don't you?
Yes, I guess it is.
She loved Paul like a brother, and she'd never been prouder of him, and she'd already made her own decision to stay and fight while Josh got Swan to safety, a plan that Swan didn't yet know about. Swan was listening to the tumult of voices, and in her mind was something she knew she should stand up and say. But there were so many people crowded in there, and she was still shy about speaking before strangers. Still, the thought was important, and she knew she had to speak her mind before the chance passed. She drew a deep breath and stood up.
"Excuse me," she said, but her voice was drowned out by the cacophony.
She walked to the front, stood beside Paul, and faced the crowd. Her heart was fluttering like a little bird, and her voice trembled as she said, just a little louder,
"Excuse me, I want to..."
The tumult started to die down almost at once. In another few seconds, there was silence but for the wail of the wind around the walls and the crying of an infant at the back of the church. Swan looked out at all of them. They were waiting for her to speak. She was the center of attention, and it made her feel as if ants were running up and down her backbone. At the back of the church, more people pressed around the door, and maybe 200 others were assembled out in the road, hearing what was said as it was passed back through the crowd. All eyes were on Swan, and she thought for a second that her throat had closed up.
"Excuse me," she managed, "but I'd like to say something."
She hesitated, trying to arrange her thoughts.
It seems to me," she began tentatively, "that we're all worried about whether we're going to be able to fight the soldiers off or not. And that's the wrong thing to be thinking of. If we have to fight them here in Mary's Rest, we're going to lose. And if we run and leave everything to them, they'll destroy it all. Because that's what armies do."
She saw Robin standing over on the right side of the church, surrounded by several of his highwaymen. Their eyes met and held for a few seconds.
"We can't win if we fight," Swan continued. "And we can't win if we run, either. So it seems to me that what we should be doing is thinking about stopping them from getting here."
Bud Royce laughed harshly. "How the hell do we stop an army if we don't fight 'em?
We make it cost too much for them to get here. They might decide to turn back,
Right, Royce smiled sarcastically. What do you suggest, Missy?
That we turn Mary's Rest into a fort, like the cowboys used to do in the old movies when they knew the Indians were coming. We build walls around Mary's Rest. We can use dirt, fallen trees, sticks, even the wood from this place. We can dig ditches out in the forest and cover them over with brush for their trucks to fall into. We can block the roads with logs so they'll have to use the woods.
Ever heard of infantry? Royce asked. Even if we did build traps for their vehicles, the soldiers would still crawl right over the walls, wouldn't they?
Maybe not, Swan said, especially if the walls were covered with ice.
Ice? A sallow-faced woman with stringy brown hair stood up. How are we supposed to conjure up ice?
We've got a spring, Swan reminded her. We've got buckets, pails, and washtubs. We've got horses to pull wagons, and we've got 3 or 4 days.
Swan walked up the aisle, her gaze moving from face to face. She was still nervous, but not so much now, because she sensed that they wanted to listen.
If we start working right now, we could build a wall around Mary's Rest, and we could figure out a system to get the water to it. We could start pouring water onto the wall even before it's finished, and as cold as it is, it wouldn't take long for the water to freeze. The more water we use, the thicker the ice. The soldiers won't be able to climb over.
No way, Roy scoffed. There's no damn time to do a job like that. Hell, we gots to try, the skinny black man said. Ain't no choice.
Other voices rose and fell, and arguments sparked. Sister started to shout them down, but she knew it was Swan's moment, and it was Swan they wanted to hear. When Swan spoke again, the arguments ceased.
You could help more than anybody, she said to Bud Royce. Since you were a captain in the National Guard, you could figure out where to put the ditches and traps, couldn't you?
Well, that'd be the easy part, Missy, but I don't want to help. I'm getting the hell out of here at first light.
She nodded, staring at him serenely. If that was his choice, so be it.
All right, she said, and she looked again at the crowd. I think whoever wants to go should leave tomorrow morning. Good luck to all of you, and I hope you find what you're searching for.
She glanced again at Robin. He felt a thrill of excitement course through him, because her eyes seemed to be aflame.
I'm staying, she said. I'm going to do what I can to stop the soldiers from destroying what we've done, all of us, each and every one. Because it wasn't just me who grew the corn, it was everybody. I put the seeds in the ground and covered them with dirt, but somebody else built the bonfires that kept the dirt and the air warm. Other people kept the bobcats and crows away, and more people picked the corn. How many of you helped dig the spring out? Who helped gather the apple cores and worked to put this building back together?
She saw they were all listening, even Bud Royce, and she had the sensation of drawing strength from them. She kept going, powered by their belief.
It wasn't just me. It was everybody who wanted to build things back again. Mary's Rest isn't just a bunch of old shacks full of strangers anymore. People know each other and work together and take an interest in the hardships everybody else has, because we know we're not so different from one another. We all know what we've lost, and if we give it up and run, we'll lose it all over again. So I'm staying right here, she said. If I live or die, that's all right, because I've decided to stop running.
There was a silence.
That's all I've got to say.
She went back to sit beside Josh. He put a hand on her shoulder and felt her trembling. The silence stretched. Bud Royce was still on his feet, but his eyes weren't as hard as they had been, and his forehead was creased with thought. Sister didn't speak either. Her heart swelled with pride for Swan, but Sister knew full well that the army wasn't coming just for the crops and the fresh water. They were coming for Swan, too. The man with the scarlet eye was leading them there, and he was going to use the human hand to crush her.
Walls covered with ice, Royce mused aloud. That's the craziest thing I've ever heard of. Hell, it's so crazy. It might just work. Might, I said. It won't stop the soldiers very long if they want to come over bad enough. Depends on what kind of weapons they've got. We break enough suspensions and axles and vehicle traps, and they might think twice.
Then it can be done?
Sister asked. I didn't say that, lady. It'd be a mighty big job, and I don't know if we've got the manpower to do it.
Manpower my ass, Anna McClay told him. What about woman power? And we've got plenty of kids who can work, too.
Her rowdy voice drew shouts of assent. Well, we wouldn't need too many people and guns to hold the walls, Royce said, especially if we leveled the woods and didn't leave those bastards any cover. We don't want them sneaking up on us.
We can fix it so they won't,
a small voice said. A brown-haired boy of about 10 or 11 stood up on the bench. He filled out since Sister had seen him last, and his cheeks were wind-burned. She knew that under his coat there would be a small round scar just below his heart. Bucky said,
If they're north of here, we can take a car and go find them.
He drew a long-bladed knife from the folds of his coat.
It wouldn't be nothing to hide in the woods and pop a few of their tires when they wasn't looking.
It sure would help, Royce agreed. Anything we can do to slow them down would give us more time to dig and build. Wouldn't be a bad idea to post lookouts about 50 miles up the road, either.
I doubt if you've had much time behind a wheel, Paul told Bucky. If I can get a car that doesn't sound like an elephant in heat, I'll do the driving. I've had a little experience in hunting wolves.
I've got an axe, another man said. It ain't too sharp, but it'll get the job done. Other people stood up, volunteering.
We can tear down some of the empty shacks and use that wood, too,
a Hispanic man with a pale violet keloid on his face suggested. Okay, we'll have to round up all the saws and axes we can find, Bud Royce told Sister. Jesus, I guess I always was half nuts. I might as well go the whole shell. We'll have to assign the work details and thrash out the schedules, and we better get started right now.
Right, Sister said. And everybody who doesn't want to help should leave and stay out of the way starting this minute.
About 15 people left, but their places were instantly filled by others from outside. As the crowd settled down again, Sister glanced at Swan and saw the determination in her face. She knew that Swan had indeed made her decision, and she knew also that Swan was not going to be persuaded to flee Mary's Rest and leave everyone else there to face the soldiers. So Sister thought, we take it one step at a time, one step, and then the next gets you where you're going.
We know what we have to do, she told the crowd. Let's get to work and save our town.
Chapter 80 The hurting sound echoed through the freezing air, and Swan flinched. She pulled back on the rope bridle, checking Mule to a walk, and steam burst from Mule's nostrils, as if he too had heard and been disturbed by the noise. More hurting sounds came to her, like the quick high whine of notes played on a steel guitar, but Swan knew she had to endure them. They were the sounds of living trees being chopped down to be added to the 4-foot-high wall of logs, brush, and dirt that encircled Mary's Rest and the crop field. Over the hurting sounds, Swan heard the steady chipping of axes at work. She said,
Go on, Mule.
And she guided the horse along the wall, where dozens of people were piling up more brush and timbers. All of them looked up and paused for a second as she passed, then returned to work with renewed urgency. Bud Royce had told her, Sister, and Josh that the wall needed to be at least 6 feet tall before the water was poured onto it. But time was getting short. It had taken over 20 hours of non-stop back-breaking labor to get the wall to its present height and circumference. Out on the rapidly receding edge of the forest, work crews, headed by Anna McClay, Royce, and other volunteers, were busy digging a network of trenches, then hiding them under a latticework of sticks, straw, and snow.
Ahead of her was a group of people packing stones and dirt into chinks in the wall, their breath wisping up into the air. Among them was Sister, her hands and clothes grimy, her face reddened by the cold. A length of sturdy twine was draped around her neck and looped to the handle of the leather satchel. Nearby, Robin was unloading another wheelbarrow full of dirt. Swan knew he'd wanted to go with Paul Bucky and the three other young highwaymen when they'd headed north the day before in a gray Subaru, but Sister had told him they needed his muscle on the wall. Swan reined Mule in and got off. Sister saw her and scowled.
"What are you doing out here? I thought I told you to stay in the shack."
"You did." Swan scooped up a double handful of dirt and jammed it into a chink.
"I'm not going to stay there while everybody else works."
Sister lifted her hands to show Swan. They were crisscrossed by bleeding gashes made by small, sharp-edged stones.
"You've got to save your hands for better things. Go on now. Your hands will heal. So will mine."
Swan packed more dirt and rocks into a hole between two logs. About 20 yards away, a number of men were wrestling more logs and brush into position as the wall grew higher. Robin looked up at the low, ugly sky.
"It'll be dark in another hour. If they're anywhere near, we might be able to see their fires."
"Paul will let us know if they're getting close," she hoped.
She knew that Paul had volunteered for a very dangerous job. If the soldiers caught him and the boys, they were as good as dead. She glanced at Swan, her fear for Paul nagging at her.
"Go on, Swan. There's no need for you to be out here tearing your hands up. I'm not different, damn it!"
Swan suddenly shouted, straightening up from her work. Her eyes flashed with anger, and crimson burst in her cheeks.
"I'm a person, not some piece of glass on a damn shelf. I can work as hard as anybody, and you don't need to make it easy on me."
Sister was amazed at Swan's outburst, and aware that the others were watching as well.
"I'm sorry," Swan said, calming down, "but you don't have to shut me away and protect me. I can take care of myself."
She looked around at the others, at Robin, and then her gaze returned to Sister.
"I know why that army's coming here, and I know who's bringing them. It's me they want. It's because of me the whole town's in danger."
Her voice cracked and her eyes teared up.
"I want to run. I want to get away, but I know that if I do, the soldiers will still come. They'll still take all the crops, and they won't leave anybody alive, so there's no need to run. But if everybody here dies, it's because of me. Me! So please let me do what I can."
Sister knew Swan was right. She, Josh, and the others had been treating Swan like a fragile piece of porcelain, or like, yes, she thought, like one of those sculptures back in the Steuben Glass Shop on Fifth Avenue. All of them had focused on Swan's gift of stirring life from dead earth, and they'd forgotten that she was just a girl. Still, Sister feared for Swan's hands, because those were the instruments that might yet make life bloom from the wasteland. But Swan was strong-minded and tough, far beyond her years, and she was ready to work.
"I wish you'd find a pair of gloves, but I guess those are hard to come by."
Sister's own pair had already worn out.
"Well," she said, "let's get to work then. Time's wasting."
She returned to her task. A pair of tattered woolen gloves was held up before Swan's face.
"Take them,"
Robin urged. His own hands were now bare. "I can always steal some more." Swan looked into his eyes. Behind his tough mask, there was a spark of gentle kindness, as if the sun had suddenly glinted through the snow clouds. She motioned towards Sister.
"Give them to her."
He nodded. His heart was racing, and he thought that if he did something stupid this time, he would crawl in a hole and just cover himself over. Oh, she was so beautiful. "Don't do something stupid," he warned himself. "Be cool, man. Just be cool." His mouth opened.
"I love you,"
he said. Sister's eyes widened. She straightened up from her work and turned toward Robin and Swan. Swan was speechless. Robin wore a horrified grin as if he